This is probably the first time this type of project has ever been done globally. It is the biggest ever study of its type. So we have 900 people in the study, which will mean that we'll be able to get all sorts of amazing insights about what's happening in those people's careers and how engineering is changing and so on.
Kia ora, I'm Troy, here as CEO, and welcome to Stirring the Pot. Thanks for connecting. If you're new, here's what you can expect. We're going to be talking the tough stuff, the things that keep us metalheads up at night. There are many challenges facing our industry and equally many opinions on how we should tackle them. Stirring the Pot provides a facilitated forum to discuss and challenge these viewpoints.
So let's get to the nuts and bolts of it. Today we are talking with Inder Crossan, an Associate Professor and Director of Engineering Management Programs at the University of Canterbury. Join us as we delve into the Belong Eng project that he leads, which is the biggest ever longitudinal study of engineering practice.
Inder, can you tell us a bit more about the Belong Eng project and how amazing it is?
Yeah, so the Belong Eng project is a longitudinal of engineering practice. What this actually means is that we're tracking the careers of hundreds of engineers across Australia and New Zealand. What's really great about this project, look, this is probably the first time this type of project has ever been done globally. It is the biggest ever study of its type. So we have 900 people in the study, which will mean that we'll be able to get all sorts of amazing insights about what's happening in those people's careers and how engineering is changing and so on. So people, your listeners might be familiar with the big Dunedin study. But so think of it like the Dunedin study, but for engineers.
Yeah, that's a cool analogy. And there have been some longitudinal studies done in the UK and the US, and they have found, I guess, what I would describe as the hegemonic masculine culture being a problem. What do you think is possible to uncover in terms of causes for women not entering the profession and leaving at a high rate? What can we actually uncover from studies like this?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so certainly, look, it is well known in all sorts of literature about some of the challenges of, not only attracting women into the profession, but also when they leave. I guess the benefits of this study is that we'll actually be able to start to cast, I guess, a New Zealand and Australian lens on what's actually happening in our industries, and really start to unpack not only the, I guess, the challenges that women and more broadly underrepresented groups in engineering are experiencing, but also have a look at where people are really thriving and start to understand why that is happening so that we can actually start to spread some of the really good news stories about, how do we attract more people in and how do we keep more people in.
And what is the current baseline of data? So, I have read similar studies from overseas, but nothing for Australia or New Zealand. What existing data is there to draw upon, or will this be the new baseline?
Sure. Yeah. So in the Belong Eng project, we completed, participants completed the first survey last year. So what their data actually looks like for those 900 participants is that we have about 600 data points for each participant. And that includes all sorts of really rich information. Think of it almost like a bit of a engineering census, along with some labor force statistics stuff, some psychometric measures in there too, looking at things like stress and well-being and, I guess, belonging to the profession, and that's where partly the name comes from, and also then looking at the specific activities the engineers are actually doing in their work. And look, there have been some prior longitudinal studies in engineering. With those studies, most of those studies stop about 5 years after people graduate. So we actually don't know really what happens in really rich detail about what happens after that 5 year period. The other thing with the prior longitudinal studies in engineering is that their population size or the number of people in their study was really quite small, and they relied a lot on interview techniques, which is a really rich way of getting information. But if you're looking at really broader populations, the survey is one of the better ways of doing that. So that's what sets this study a little bit apart from those previous studies.
And what are the demographics looking like at the moment in terms of the participants, and what genders and ages they cover, and what disciplines of engineering they cover?
Yeah, sure. Great question. So first of all, thank you to the 889 participants in the study. If you are one of those people, thank you for sharing your study, also sharing your story with us. We have a really rich diversity of people in the study. So about 35% of the participants live in New Zealand, and the rest, or most of the rest, live in Australia, but they're actually all over the world. So these are graduates from engineering institutions, both in New Zealand and Australia, and they're now living sometimes elsewhere. In terms of the gender mix, we're actually overrepresented with women in the study. So we have about 28% of people who say that they're women or female. Most of the others are men or male. And then we do have a handful of people who are identifying other genders or sex. Age-wise, we are slightly skewed towards younger people, and that probably is in part due to what we actually had some criteria on people who could join, and we said to people, look, if you're thinking about retiring within the next 10 years, this project probably isn't ready for you, because we want to be tracking you over 20 years. So we've probably cut off some of the older people in the study. That being said, look, we do have some older people in the study as well. In terms of ethnicities, trying to even define ethnicity is hard, but we do have a really rich ethnicity mix in there. About 80% of the people in the study are the first engineers in their family, which is a pretty cool insight. And then we have a mixture of people with different engineering qualifications, ranging from, you know, a 2 year qualification all the way through to a PhD. We do have a sprinkling of people who actually don't have engineering qualifications, but who have been recognized by one of the peak bodies as an engineer. In terms of the disciplines, one of the hardest things we had to grapple with when we were designing the project and the survey was trying to actually identify all of the engineering disciplines. So yes, there are the classic, civil, mechanical, electrical, chemical, and so on. But the more we got into it, we realized that it's actually really hard to define an engineering discipline. And there is no taxonomy of engineering disciplines. So we tried our best, and we gave people choices to nominate their disciplines. But then we got even more disciplines back. What was particularly interesting about this, though, is that when we asked people about their engineering discipline, they could actually tag multiple disciplines. And some people were tagging up to 10 different disciplines, which I guess for me was quite interesting. Is that it's have to be really cautious about pigeonholing people. Often you might need to ask them how they see themselves.
Mm-hmm. That is interesting. Of course, in a longitudinal study, after only its first year in 20. It's hard to draw any conclusions, but are there any interesting initial findings like what you just mentioned that have come out?
Yeah. So there's some other interesting things too, and we are expecting, you know, people's careers to change. And at the moment, yeah, so the best we have is a bit of a snapshot in time. But it's a really interesting point in time, obviously, with, you know, the COVID pandemic and the impact of that on people's work life. But and that we're starting to see some of that in the data. So to give you an example, in the 12 months prior to people completing the survey, one in four changed jobs at least once. And I think that does resonate, you know, with when you hear about, you know, the amount of churn that's been happening in the last year or more. And that one in four statistic lines up pretty well with what the Australian Bureau of Statistics started reporting late last year, was that about one in five professionals left their job in the last 12 months. Some other interesting things that came out of it too, we surveyed about how many hours people worked. This one wasn't, for me, surprising. And I think it just confirms something about the workforce, is that most of the engineers in the study were working between 40 to 49 hours a week. So it's a really quite long hours. Some other interesting aspects that came out of it was that one in five of the participants had a business or a management qualification. And that is the first time we've been able to actually uncover that bit of data. If you recall, when you were completing your census, you were probably asked about your highest qualification. It doesn't ask anything about what other qualifications you had. So when we've been looking at historical census data, we haven't been able to determine how many different qualifications engineers have. And now it's the first time we have that data, at least in a bit more of an open forum. Some of the universities probably have that data, but now we've been able to uncover that. Some other interesting things too. It's been pretty well known that engineering is a socio-technical discipline. Yes, the technical is really important, but then there's the people element of it too. And the first baseline data confirmed a lot of previous research, which suggests that engineers spend around 50% of their time collaborating with other people. And so it really confirms that, yes, it is 50% about people and 50% around the technical. But what's really cool about this project now is that we'll be able to actually start to look at the nuances around that collaboration. Is this a learnt activity that graduates build up over time? And how is it different, for example, between different disciplines? And I guess, look, with a lot of these statistics too, is that it's still, we've only sampled 900 engineers, and it might not be truly representative of the broader population. That there will be bias in our sample, but it is something that we've now been able to quantify. And as I mentioned too, it really starts to add to nuance of some of the things we already knew.
That is interesting. It seems like engineers are a lot more cross-disciplinary, multidisciplinary, collaborating than I guess the stereotype gives them credit for. And I was reading one of the articles that you had sent a reference to previously, which looked at the stereotype that new teachers had of engineers. And obviously, you know, if you're having engineers with a high proportion of them having secondary degrees in a different discipline and crossing over into multiple engineering disciplines, that's quite interesting in terms of how the data could actually portray engineers as people.
That's right. And certainly, though, look, that's one of the ideas that we've had as a project team, is there a little side project in here where we can actually start to really unpack how engineering is portrayed, and then start to actually use the outcomes of our study to help inform how we actually market engineering? You know, it is cross-disciplinary by nature, and it is deeply social, that the engineers aren't just sitting in isolation. Sometimes they are, but in the vast majority of cases, they're actually working with people a lot of the time.
Yeah. I would imagine that some of the longer-term research outcomes are going to show, you know, what is reflected in the statistics more broadly, that there will be a drop-off of women in particular from the industry. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering how will you, I guess, manage that deficit reporting, which would be reflective of the reality, but also balancing that against not being so alarmist to put new women entering in the study and profession off from entering? How will you?
Yeah, that's great question. Yeah. So yeah, look, the tension of deficit reporting is real, and it's something that we really thought about deeply when we were developing the project. And look, in some instances, I think revealing data and pulling back the realities of practice, sometimes it needs to be called out. It shouldn't be hidden. And that can be really uneasy, but that can also be a real force for positive change. On the other hand, if we're not careful, reporting can just reinforce existing prejudices or stereotypes which might not really exist. So for example, the stereotype that engineers are introverted, that might not be true. And we do have mechanisms in place to try and avoid deficit reporting whenever we can, and to focus on what I call the green shoots, or the positive elements that are, you know, bucking the trend, that we can actually start to share and really pass some positive light on the engineering industry. So to give you an example, one of the things that we've uncovered in the first data wave was that the electrical engineers seem to be the least stressed of all of the engineering disciplines. We don't know why, but there is probably something that we can learn from those engineers to help in other industries where there are known problems, such as the construction industry. So that's just an example of how we'd like to try and move away from deficit reporting, acknowledging that sometimes it is actually needed.
There was also some interesting early indicators that you had around mentoring and stress and a particular link there. What can you tell us about that might be emerging?
Yeah, for sure. So people's stories are really complicated, and we've tried our best to capture some of those stories through a survey and measurement. And it can be a little bit tricky to unpack people's stories, but we can use different statistical techniques to try and really uncover some of the different factors that are leading to a particular outcome. So, for example, what you picked up on was mentoring and stress. So one of the early bits of analysis that we did indicated that people with mentors were really highly stressed. And we went, oh no, is this is giving people mentors resulting in them having higher stress? Or is it something more nuanced and complicated? You know, are these people who have mentors, are they really conscientious? And is that what is potentially driving stress. So with, to give you an example, with that stress one, we thought, well, let's unpack to see who is more likely to have a mentor. And it turns out that women in the study are actually twice as more likely to have a mentor than men. Then it also turned out that women were more stressed than the men. So in essence, the mentoring stress relationship that we were seeing was actually being driven by some other underlying factors, one of which was the relationship between stress and gender. So at the moment, we're still really unpacking a lot of those factors that contribute to those outcomes. And that's useful because we'll be able to start to really shed some light about, you know, what are the positive things that organizations can do to lead to better career outcomes.
Do you think that there are any demographic components or elements that are missing or not well represented? And, you know, is there a plan to get more information on those people who might be missing out on being?
Yeah, for sure. So it's very difficult to capture everything and everyone. And when we were designing the survey, we had to be really careful about the balance between annoying participants by serving them for too long, and also the richness of the data. So to give you an idea, one of the things we considered including in the survey was to capture the occupation of people's primary caregivers as they were growing up. So to give an example, my father was a pharmacist, my mother was a nurse. Although that's only, you know, one, two or more questions, depending on how many caregivers you had, it was just one more question that people had to answer. And the other thing too is that if we had, you know, 1,000 participants, then it would actually require the researchers then to code that data, which takes more time. And then there's also some really sensitive topics that, again, we at the moment, we don't necessarily want to ask, but we might consider it in the future. At the moment, we're still trying to gain participants' trust. So there have been questions from other people about, you know, are you asking about sexuality? At the moment, we're not, because again, it's probably another burden on the participants that we're really mindful of. In terms of action, so that's, I guess, the survey data. So yeah, look, that there are missing data, but it is that balance. We'll probably add some interesting things in, like one of the things that's come up in the last year is the use of artificial intelligence tools. That's something that we're probably going to include in the next survey. Because yeah, it's really quite topical. And then we'll probably get rid of some questions, you know, for example, once COVID dampens down a lot, we might actually start to get rid of some of those questions. But yeah, getting a representative sample of engineers was really hard. Took about 6 months worth of work. And the way we did that was through some of the usual channels. Social media advertising, we advertised in professional membership magazines, and we also recruited through the tertiary institutions across New Zealand and Australia. But sometimes we couldn't get all of those institutions to participate. So, for example, here in New Zealand, a lot of the polytechs were right in the middle of the Te Pūkenga merger. And so it was very, very difficult for them to help us recruit. As a result, we've probably missed out on a whole bunch of people with 2 and 3 year qualifications that would have otherwise joined the study. The other one too that we're acutely aware of too is the representation of Māori and Pacifica people in studies is still low. What that actually means is that when we're actually representing their stories, we have to be really, really careful about doing that, because there's so few people in the studies, in the study who have a particular demographic. We have to be quite careful. So to give you an example, if we want to focus on the outcomes of Māori participants, it has to be focused not on deficit, but on what are the strengths, because otherwise it'll just reinforce existing stereotypes. And we also have to really work closely with our Māori research kaiorahi or guider when we're actually doing that research.
There is a lot of work, obviously, in this, not only in preparation with getting people engaged in the study, but also in coding and analysing the data. Has the project got research funding?
Great question. Yeah, so I joined the University of Canterbury in 2020, and that's when the project was right at its infancy. And as a new staff member here, I was actually given some cash support by the university to drive the research that I wanted to do. So that the vast chunk of that money went into developing this project. This project, it needed to happen. It had been sort of on my radar for years, and the timing was right, so I just had to do it. In terms of external funding, there is no external funding at the moment. I am in discussions with some of the engineering peak bodies about potential funding, and I'm hopeful that that will come through. And then obviously I am looking to some of the government-led research funding that's available, not only here but also in Australia. So the money has dried up for the moment, but we have, the structures in place to keep going with the project. I still have time. Part of my job, I can actually keep doing this project. And thankfully, the University of Canterbury has also funded a PhD candidate too. And that PhD candidate will be starting, next week. Which will be fantastic. And we're always looking for more funding, because it does require, as you say, people hours to actually drive the stats. The data set's 500,000 data points already. It's going to double come July this year, and it's going to get bigger and bigger after that. And you need people to drive that and to really start gleaning those insights that we're all desperately in need of and keen to hear about.
Yeah, definitely. And what are the next steps for the research program?
Right. Yeah. So the next steps, we are rolling out the next survey around June this year, May, June, July this year. So the next steps are to design the next survey. A lot of that will be rolling over and redesigning or reconfiguring the questions from the last survey. And then really it's starting to unpack some of the complexity in people's stories and the data. So that's something that the PhD student will start doing with us, is really start to unpack the complexities to understand what's actually going on here. And then we can start to identify some things that we want to research more, that is of particular interest, not only to us, but to the broader engineering community. So that's what's happening next. The other things that are happening, we want this to be more than just an academic exercise. We want this to have real long-term impact on engineering practice. So we want to see change happening. So with that, is outreach activities to really get the message out there about what this project is about, some of the insights that we're able to glean, and so on. So I'm heading up to Auckland tomorrow to meet some engineering consulting companies to talk about the project. But yeah, look, more broadly, if any of the listeners want to know more about the project, just feel free to get in contact with me. We do have a project website, www.belongeng.org, and you can find out some more information about the project there. We also have the baseline report is available through there as well. Not all of the data, there's some data that was sensitive that we had to hide, but there's some really interesting insights in that first data wave.
So there you go. Thanks for joining our conversation with Inder today. If you'd like to connect more with him, you'll find his details in the show notes. This is very exciting research, which will no doubt shape the future of engineering. The understanding of the role of engineers is evolving, and the desire to make engineering processes and outcomes more inclusive and sustainable along with it. Food for thought till we see you next time. So hit subscribe, and if you liked what you heard today, please like, review, or share with any metal minds you know. Let's spread the word. Engineers help change the world we live in, shaping economic, environmental, and social outcomes. The nature of work is also changing, and it's shaped by economic, technological, and societal changes. The conversation of equity has been an ongoing one within the heavy engineering industry, and the BelongEng project might be a way in which we can provide evidence for policy and change in the engineering practices and education, particularly when it comes to the diversity conversation. If you'd like to know more about this project, you'll find details in the show notes.